Let's get close.
Every time I heard you say that. Hey, everybody. Hey everybody, this is Chris Briley and Phil Kaplan. Oh, I'm mixing it up. It's a different intro. This is the Green Architects Lounge, everybody. Welcome. How are you, Phil?
I'm doing great, Chris. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. Yeah, boy, we just kind of went into that intro all different than last time. You know why? It's because I'm excited.
I know why you're excited.
I'm excited because we got a great guest coming up, John Straub. I can't imagine you know who we are, yet don't know who he is, so it's going to be ridiculous that I'm going to do an intro, but I'll do it proper anyway. So we're excited.
Yeah, you know, we've been watching this guy talk and listening to him and reading his stuff for years, and at the last NESE Building Energy Conference, I managed to get in line after one of his lectures and got his attention and say, hey, John, what do you think about doing a podcast with us? We know you've got one on GBA. Would you be interested in doing one where we dig a little deeper to find who the man, the legend is? And he was interested, so we're psyched to have him today.
Which is fantastic and lucky for us. And you got his autograph, right?
I wasn't that lucky. No.
That's too bad. Well, maybe later, because we're gonna owe him a drink. We're doing this remotely.
I had a big chunk of moldy sheetrock that I was trying to get him to sign, and and the Sharpie just wouldn't take.
So. Oh, well, we'll definitely get him to sign some piece of mold. There. All right. So we got that going on, but this is all weird for us, and that's another reason why I'm off my game here, is because it's the morning, so we're not doing cocktails right now. Cheers, Phil.
Cheers.
That is our plastic mugs, our insulated mugs.
That's clinking. Sad. Isn't that sort of sad?
It's pathetic. We're pathetic. But I'm a little coffee addict, and you probably are too. And
oh, it's decaf.
Oh,
I
really?
I kid you not.
Switching to decaf?
I kid you not.
Oh my god, that's why you're acting weird. Okay,
one of the reasons.
Oh, how are we gonna get through this, Phil?
We're gonna make it, Chris. Give us a little bio on our friend Dr. Scott.
Well, you know, I think we'll do that when we intro. I'll intro him when we bring him in.
Sounds great.
But everyone knows him. So let's do this.
First, you know what I'd like to hear?
Yes. What?
What drink are we going to consume?
Oh, that's a great idea. That is a great idea. Because here's how it's going to go down, people. We're going to promise to drink something later. And if timing works out and we can record it and you can join us, then great. But as some of you know, we have a relationship with fine cooking for cocktails. Well, sort of. And Mr. Boston, but that's a loose relationship. But so we're going to do the limoncello gin cocktail with grilled thyme, although I don't know if the thyme's going to actually be grilled, but we'll do something with it. But
maybe pull it out of a plastic container from Hannaford and thrown in
exactly.
the drink.
And we'll muddle it or something. Okay, we'll do something great like that. But anyway, it's two large fresh thyme sprigs, about half an ounce of fresh lime juice, 1.5 fluid ounces of gin, and they say preferably Blue Coat American Dry. Have you ever had that?
I have not.
Neither have I.
It sounds fancy.
Whatever.
I'm down with it.
And then 1/2 ounce of limoncello, preferably, and they say Averna Limone di Sicilia.
Your Italian is impeccable.
I don't know. It's awful. I can't do Italian very well. So that's what we're going to have. And then, Phil, you're going to, when we're done interviewing John, we're going to go out with your music, the song of the episode, what we should be listening to in studio. What's happening?
This is going to be your new favorite album, Chris.
Is it?
This is the summer disc of 2012.
Oh, I am so ready.
The band is called Tan Lines, and the album is called Mixed Emotions. You're never going to guess where they're from, Chris.
If you say Brooklyn, I'm going to punch you in the eye. I'm going to punch you right now.
You know, I secretly want to live in Brooklyn.
Are they from Brooklyn?
They're from Brooklyn.
Here's the puncher, buddy.
Oh, damn. Ow, I did get hit there.
Yeah. You deserve it. Diversify. Okay.
I didn't even know. It just sticks to me.
All right. Like, but tan lines, I love that.
Yeah.
That sounds like summer all over.
Doesn't
or
it?
Or in places.
It's two guys. if you like Vampire Weekend, if you like Rapture, if you like maybe Hot Chip, like these guys.
All right. It sounds like I am going to like them.
The song's called Lost Somewhere.
Lost Somewhere.
And we're going to rock out to our limoncello gin cocktails with grilled thyme and listen to Tan Lines, you and me, later.
All right. Fantastic. So, everybody, stay tuned. And just a reminder, You can always email us at galounge@greenbuildingadvisor.com. Phil and I and Sheila love to get your emails, your requests. Hey, you know what? Send a cocktail recipe. Just slap it on the back of a bottle of scotch and email it to galounge@greenbuildingadvisor.com. Also, check out our lame Facebook page that we like to visit. And otherwise, let's stay tuned because John Straub is coming up.
Very excited.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us here at the Green Building Advisors Green Architects Lounge. Phil.
Chris.
And with us on the line is John Straub. John, how are you?
I'm excellent.
Excellent.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today, John.
Love it.
And I know everyone out there, if anyone knows who we are, they have to know who you are, but I'm going to do a nice official intro anyway. John Straub, he's recently received a Lifetime Achievement Award in Building Science Education from the National Consortium of Housing Research Centers, and that's pretty good to get a Lifetime Achievement Award at age whatever you are, because... Because you're not that old, John, or you don't seem it.
You're putting him on the spot.
I am.
No, I don't feel that old, but right. I was quite pleased and surprised and honored.
Right.
I guess one of the things, though, is that I have had the luck that I have really only been in this industry. I'm not a reinvented physicist. I'm not a reinvented software engineer. I'm not a reinvented builder or architect. I have been working on this type of stuff literally from my first kind of high school work, summer work job. So in a sense, I've kind of been working at it for a while. It occurs to me now when I run into people my age who this is their second or third career. It's like, geez, does that mean I'm supposed to change soon?
No, I think now that means you can kick back. Now you can just relax. Lifetime achievement done. No,
that's right. You got to start early. You know, we were wondering if you were, you know, when you were a baby lying in the crib, staring up and looking at a moldy ceiling, that something just hit you, and
it's like, I know what I'm going to be.
It did take a little longer than that, actually. I have to say.
Yeah. All right. Well, my intro. Okay, wait. Let me finish my intro. It's all official. He's also a faculty member of the Department of Civil Engineering and the School of Architecture at the University of Waterloo. That's in Canada, Americans. Where he teaches courses in structural design, material science, and building science. At Waterloo, he's the director of building of the Building Engineering Group and also a faculty member of the School of Architecture. He is also the founding principal of the consulting firm Building Science Consulting, the Canadian partner to the infamous Building Science Corp.
Infamous.
He is a popular contributor here on the Green Building Advisor. And you yourself, John, I don't know if you know this, but you're like, if you put your name in the search engine, you come up like over 200 times, just yourself, but also people referencing you in their comments.
Are you sure that's just because it's too hard? It's not too hard to spell Stebrook.
Yeah, it's easier to spell and say my name. You know, a little known fact is that, of course, way back centuries ago, my family dropped the L off the beginning of mine.
That's good. Yeah, mine is now. Oh, sorry, without the silent Q or whatever. Yeah, that is a weird name. But yeah, so now that's why we asked you instead of him, because Joe, it's just too hard to type in the email.
Is that it?
Yeah, no. All right. He's also co-authored the book Building Science for Building Enclosures back in 2005, and is the recent author of the book High Performance Enclosures. Hot off the press, and I ordered mine last night.
Yeah, congratulations on that. Tell us a little bit about the new book.
Thank you, guys. That's good. Well, I'll tell you, I was actually kind of excited about this one. It took us a while to finally push it out the door, but I'm hoping it'll be really useful to, the more commercial architect side of things.
Right, and it is for cold climates, is that right?
Yeah, it's basically zone 4 and up. So I think we need to make another book from zone 4 and down. So it's intended about, where heat loss is more important, condensation in the wintertime is more important than summertime. Stuff like that is why we kind of drew the line.
Right. And if someone's interested in this book, really they're, like those infamous questions, infamous again, that's my word of the podcast, I guess, about like load-bearing masonry. I'm assuming you cover that in there, possibly?
I do. Fantastic. I do. I talk about it, but it's it is. There are some details in there on interior insulation retrofits, but also and new construction. But it's really it is a lot focused on new institutional commercial building types.
Great. I think that's really timely because I think like there's a lot of info out there on homes and you know doing deep energy retrofits and passive houses and net zero and all that, and then commercial projects, it's still sort of just doing the best that they can in places and what makes sense. And there's a huge industry out there that's sort of maintaining a status quo. It's really hard to move it. So
and that is actually what really drove the book was that while there's still lots of questions and lots of confusion in the residential market, both new build for high performance and retrofit, there's a lot more conversation, you know, as evidenced by GBA. There's a lot of intelligent people with experience talking about this, and there's books written. But there's a real commercials, frankly, playing a catch-up game to the residential side. We don't have anything like a Building America for commercial or a passive house for commercial, although they'll call it the same.
Right.
There are differences, and there is ASHRAE 90.1, the Commercial Energy Code, has really upped the bar recently, and so there's quite a vacuum. There needs to be the same sort of paradigm shift that occurs in the home building industry has to occur in the commercial. And so this book is trying to address that need.
Well, why do you think it's taken so long for the commercial industry to get on board with this?
There's lots of complex questions to that, but really big contributors, the people who build the buildings don't actually own them, and then the people, same as in the residential sector, but when you own the building, many of the people who own the building and pay the lease don't even see the energy costs.
Yeah.
It's lost. No one has a sense of how to figure out how much it should cost. So if you speak to a homeowner and they're spending $600 a month, that's like a lot of money, and they know that.
Yeah.
Whereas in commercial buildings, there's so much, it's such a larger organization that the people who pay those bills don't talk to the people who do the leases. People don't have comparator buildings, so they can't say, how much do you use? Well, I'm in a completely different building than you are.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of what's causing the confusion, and it's just never been important to the owners to care much about, or the occupants, to care much about energy consumption. They're really being driven that way for non-economic reasons. Codes, societal expectations, carbon footprinting for their company, et cetera, is really making them do it, not because, hey, this makes economic sense,
right,
even though it does.
Do you see this as a big opportunity for building professionals as the commercial world starts to...
I see more than I'd say. I put it in the other way. I'd say it's not an opportunity; it's a threat. If the building professionals do not respond to the new paradigm of expecting performance, they will not be working. I mean, it may take us 25 years to get there, but the real push is now that we want you to deliver buildings with a meeting an air tightness target, mm-hmm. meeting an energy target. Providing more quality space, but it used to be all you had to do was meet on time, on budget, to code, and even the last to code was kind of fuzzy.
Yeah.
And now it's people are saying, oh, and I need you to get a LEED accreditation. You mean you literally, I have to? Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a whole separate performance requirement. That was what started the floodgate opening. And now there are, well, if you build for the U.S. government or you build for the U.S. military, you must meet some pretty tight air tightness standards, and you got to prove it by testing. So suddenly we're actually requiring the design team and construction team to deliver a measurable performance. And I think that's just going to accelerate. LEED was the first crack in the door. Air tightness is the door is opening. And we're going to add a whole bunch of other things like required energy targets, you know, no more than so much energy per square foot per year.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to require carbon targets. And suddenly the teams that can actually predict the performance of their buildings and then deliver it are going to be the only teams that are going to be busy, both construction and design.
And out of curiosity, I mean, I know there are standards by different codes and different certifications, but you yourself, what do you think, like if I'm doing a commercial building, let's say, oh, I don't know, a veterinary clinic or something, or some doctor's office, and I want to tell the builder, let's hit ACH 50 of X, or what do you feel are the pretty good standards that one should meet? What's the thing that's doable? And
I would look towards Architecture 2030 as an energy target.
Yeah.
Architecture2030.org has these nice lists for different areas and different building types. And they start with a 50% reduction over 1993 buildings.
Right.
That's a great start. If you should be able to meet that without spending a single dollar.
Nice. That,
there's no reason to increase the cost of construction.
Excellent.
And air tightness targets, I would use something like the government services agency's air tightness targets of 0.4 CFM per square foot at 75 pascals. In the commercial area, we don't use ACH because of the wide range of building shapes.
Right.
So that would be, those would be good starting points.
Mm-hmm.
And then, hey, once you demonstrate you can do that on a project, well, now let's ratchet it up a bit. You know, let's go for the 60% or 65% Architecture 2030 target. Let's go for the Army Corps target air tightness of 0.25. Hmm. I think actually a tougher question is, okay, those are targets for energy and air tightness. Well, buildings are much more than that. How do we start measuring and targeting good spaces, spaces that feel good to people who work in them,
mm-hmm.
combination of sound quality and daylighting and so on. Those are the ones that are going to be harder. We haven't even started figuring out how to measure what we really want to get.
Yes, that's actually a good question. Like if someone came to you and said, how do I measure my air tightness for my mall or my 50-story office building? I mean, this might be not of interest to the residential people, but I'm curious. You know, how do you go about doing that? Is it
That's actually, I think, a solved problem. I mean, people are doing it left, right, and center now.
Yeah.
And so I don't mean politically. I meant like spatially, right?
right.
So how do you do it? Well, first of all, you build a tight building.
Yeah.
And then you use a lot of blower doors.
Okay. So it's just like residential, just larger.
The difference here is that to connect them together, like the Energy Conservatory has this very cool software and hardware setup where you run cables between all your blower doors,
mm-hmm.
and then they all ramp up as a single unit. You can ramp them up and ramp them down in concert. Literally two nights ago, we were doing a, 25,000, 30,000 square foot Architects Association building for our local province, and we were doing a blower door test on this building built in the early 80s. And we installed six blower doors. We didn't need them. We actually managed to get to our tightness, our pressure targets with only three or four of them. But we've done buildings of 750,000 square feet, and others have done buildings that are much larger than that.
Mm-hmm.
My colleagues at Building Science Corp is Kota Weno did a building, a relatively tall building, like 12, 15 stories in Boston.
Nice.
So it's really, those are solved problems.
So let's step back to residential for just a sec, John.
Right.
One of Chris's comments, he asked about a pretty good veterinary clinic.
Yeah.
Have you heard anything about the pretty good house movement? Is that on your radar?
It is.
What do you think about this?
I love it. Well, I love the concept. I don't know much about the particular targets.
Right.
But I think that is a absolute good sign of maturity. Things like net zero energy homes or passive house
mm-hmm.
show us how we can get to really high performance and low energy use. But that does not mean that they are necessarily what everybody can or should build or is able to build. And so we've often at Building Science Corporation had the opinion that we could go off and build 10 net zero energy houses a year or even 20.
Mm-hmm.
But from the point of impact on the environment,
mm-hmm.
they're basically non-existent. Nothing happens. If you have 10 or 20 houses that are zero energy, who cares? It only matters when thousands and thousands of homes are done. And so we've spent a lot of our time, and many times we are criticized for it, you know, making 5,000 houses a year use 30% less energy.
Right.
And from an impact on the environment, the impact on energy security, on carbon, et cetera, well, that's way bigger. That's right. A much bigger deal.
Yeah.
And if we can demonstrate that 30% reductions can be achieved by, you know, three tracked builders, well, then it makes everyone else look bad. The fact that a bunch of highly motivated, well-funded zealots can produce net zero energy houses, well, we know we can do that.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so really those net zero energy or passive house things are really about us learning where the, you know, where the extreme is or where the next generation is.
Right.
They don't necessarily inform, although they may inspire, the current generation or the next 10 years. And so we're constantly flitting between the getting awful buildings to good, more so than getting good buildings to great. And it's just much better press to talk about great buildings. But the real the real impact is making good buildings.
Right.
And I think that if we could get the idea of a pretty good building, a pretty good home, out to tens of thousands, that's success. That's success, because then we can change pretty good over time to be, you know, a lower and lower energy number or higher and higher comfort number.
Right.
But we need to try to avoid making these houses that are really high performance just technology demonstrators, like concept cars. I don't care how many concept cars GM delivers. It really matters that their Sierra pickup truck gets 6 miles per gallon more this year than it did last year.
Exactly.
That matters.
Right. And to our listeners who aren't familiar, the pretty good house concept is sort of is being developed here in Maine, or we should out of our little building science discussion group. And really what it is like you said, John, it's not a set of standards with a certification. It's really a philosophy and guidelines and best practices methods that people, you know, everyone can subscribe to if they want to have a pretty good house. So it's sort of a doing energy efficient and green building for the masses, and not like you say, for those striving for greatness, those who are striving for, you know, pretty goodness. So
or not just striving, able to achieve.
Exactly.
I mean, not everybody can afford to build a custom home with an architect as designer. I mean, that just is out of the reach of the majority of normal Americans.
Yes.
So, but let's talk about this for a second, because maybe this stems from relationship with production builders, and maybe it's just a thing. And I know it's a thing that's been debated with when we have our conversations about a pretty good house here at our building science discussion groups. You talk a lot about still using gas at your seminars. Why don't we just draw the line and get off of fossil fuels altogether? Isn't a pretty good house off of fossil fuels?
Well, it's hard. Again, it doesn't meet that sort of common sense bar. Sure, we can get off gas, but that causes damage to the environment, worse than burning gas. Because what is my alternative? Switching to electricity? Well, in America, electricity is still a very dirty energy source. And therefore, switching from gas as a home heating or domestic hot water to electricity essentially means significantly more pollution pretty much everywhere in America. So while the end game is clear, is to avoid avoid fossil fuels, and that means eventually natural gas, I mean, well, sure, if you're comparing it to wind energy or photovoltaics, and you don't have plants that are using fossil fuels to provide the electricity, then you would be right. But it seems like it seems that most people who are adamantly opposed to natural gas use have no clue about where the electricity is coming from, or believe that they can draw a circle around the electrons that come from a wind turbine and distinguish them from the electrons that come from a coal plant.
Right. Right.
So I think it's pragmatic. We do need to continue to push. It is just a transition from fossil fuels to a true renewable future. And frankly, there's no technical argument to saying, no, no, it's okay if we still use those Ohio Valley coal plants to make our electricity. That's cleaner. It just doesn't make sense.
Right, right. But I think, you know, this isn't actually a counter argument, but actually one that's parallel to that is, you know, once we can get the energy demand down on a house, let's say, to where we're running a very efficient mini-split system.
Right,
something
with a
like
CLP
that.
Of 2 to 3.
Right, right. And we're able to use that electricity efficiently. But that's you know, depending on the philosophy of...
well, no, I would agree. I mean, just like, what do I use in my home? I use an electric-based air source heat pump.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to do that because the load was dropped. You know, the peak heating load is something like 12,000 BTUs an hour.
Right.
So it worked. That is not the low-carbon solution.
Low-carbon
solution would have been for me to use natural gas and a very little bit of it because I have only a 12,000 BTU an hour load.
Mm-hmm.
And by using the electric heat pump, I spent more money than if I had used a natural gas heating system. Cost me more capital. Costs me more operating, mm-hmm. and produces more carbon to use electricity.
Very
so there's no, why didn't I? Well, I don't have a gas pipeline running by my house.
Oh, right.
And it would have been capitally intensive to run it 7 miles from, well, actually it's more like 4 miles from the nearest gas line to my house. That
right.
would have cost more than, well, many times more than my house. So if there is no sort of, having an efficient house doesn't change anything about the argument.
Right.
On an individual basis. It may change things on a system-wide basis, because if you reduce the demand enough, then you can actually retire all the dirty plants, and then you can actually end up with a cleaner electric grid, which means that the electricity that you're using then actually is a better choice.
Right.
On the other hand, I don't see any sign other than the recent good news about shutting down some of the dirtiest coal plants that people are making decisions on our grid infrastructure based solely on what's cleaner.
Right.
They're doing it all on what's cheaper.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wait, I agree with you on that one. So
yeah, good stuff, John.
So, Phil, you want another question or two?
Yeah.
Go to a break?
No, let's ask one more. You know, you and Joe Streetbrook, you know, people sometimes think of you as the click and clack of the building science world.
Totally.
So how did you guys hook up? You know, you're these two strong, wonderful personalities that tend to be an anchor for our tribe in a lot of ways. You know, we'd love to hear you guys chat and go back and forth. You know, what's it like when you guys hang out? You know, where do you disagree?
Well, how we met, I mean, I guess we just sort of circled around each other, kind of like two feral dogs for a while, that we knew the other was out there. And I can clearly remember my first Joe Stiebrick article I read was the paint siding failures due to, you know, cellulose installations in Cleveland. That was, you know, I read that. It was like a complete insight to me. I was like, holy cow, I never had any idea. And it was amazing. And then, you know, I kept, you know, his name is rather distinctive. And so whenever I saw it came up, I read everything I could. And so by the time we, you know, met each other, I don't know whether it was at Affordable Comfort or EBA, you know, one of those standard annual conferences, we just sort of started hanging out at these conferences. And then over time, where there were specific projects, Joe and Betsy needed, say, some of our sort of geeky technical stuff on measuring and monitoring, which is something I've been doing at the university a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we started working for Building Science Corporation. And that working for turned into working with, and then turned into being subsumed by the Borg of BSC.
Mm-hmm. The Borg.
So where do you guys still disagree?
Actually, from a building science perspective, I don't really think that we disagree on much. There's all kinds of subtle nuances that one can debate about.
Mm-hmm.
About, you know, do I really need an inch and a half airspace on a 30-foot long 4 and 12 pitch roof, or is an inch enough, or maybe should it be 2 inches?
Mm-hmm.
In a building science aspect, that's what we would discuss.
Yeah.
In disagreement, it might be, you know, maybe that wine is better for me than for him. I don't see why I'd want to spend that much money on a German car. I can buy a cheaper German car. You know, those are the kinds of things that we debate about. Oh, and amongst politics, of course.
Yeah, I bet.
Oh, right, nice, yeah.
We'll hold that for another podcast.
Oh,
maybe
yeah.
Not ours.
That would be good. All right.
Maybe for us and a glass of wine sometime, John.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And we owe you a drink here because usually we're sitting with cocktails and here we are in the middle of the day, so it's not working out. But
well, I have actually an espresso here beside me.
Oh, excellent. We're doing coffee here, so we're...
That counts for something.
It's something. It's something. It's not as fun, but, you know. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break and, John, if you can stick around, we'll be right back.
Yeah.
Sure.
Back with John Straub.
Hey, John. Welcome back.
Oh, glad to be back.
Yeah. It's like almost no time passed. all right. So, Phil, what do you want to ask him? What's the burning question?
So, we're architects, John.
Yes, I know that.
Yes. You know, we smirk a little bit because we get pretty beat up. We get pretty beat when we hear you talk. We hear John.
Builders
Joe
diss
talk,
us.
We hear
engineers diss us.
Rosenbaum talk. Yeah, we get beat up. We go to Nessie Building Energy, and the architects are the losers in the group.
Yeah,
but
we're doing this crazy
actually,
stuff.
You know, guys, it's like you get beat up. Probably you only get beat up in the building science and construction world. In the design world and in the wider world, you're held up as paragons of ideals where the architects get to design these things and they're so clever and they have such great insights. But I think that's perhaps somewhat telling. If you ask where are architects, why do they make fun of them, where can they improve, it really comes down to there is an expectation that architects know a lot more than they do about how things are built. Mm-hmm. And frankly, the whole process of architectural education, I teach at such an institution and a very good one, we don't spend that much time teaching architects how things are built. And the professional work, especially in commercial, less so residentially, the architects don't get a chance to learn. And so that's one of the reasons people make fun of them on the construction site. It's like, what? How could you draw this? Of course I can't build this. But no one ever taught them how to do that. And the profession doesn't provide a way for, say, a graduate architect to spend, 30% of their first 5 years on a construction site.
Yeah.
Which would be kind of a good way to learn, if they're in commercial on a commercial site, if they're in residential on a residential site. That's one aspect. And then the other part is that the science behind making technology decisions, which is what we call building science, right? It's the physics that guide us in which technology to use. No one teaches that to architects.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before engineers get too uppity, very few engineers get taught that either. And I can promise you, if you go to enough building science conferences, there's a lot of engineers get made fun of too.
Sure.
And
we do that
on that aspect.
We do that 24/7.
Absolutely, I would encourage it.
Yeah.
So what's going on at University of Waterloo? So you're teaching there. Are you pushing back at this a little bit? Obviously, you're there for a reason. Are you helping these guys wake up?
I would say that I am responding to the reason I'm working there. I'm responding to a need that was defined by the faculties. So they wanted us to. They wanted someone to teach building science, and I was available. But I'm one guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I teach two courses in engineering in a year, and two courses in architecture in a year, and that's the total amount of available building science education at the University of Waterloo, which is sometimes an infinite amount more than at most schools of engineering and architecture.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, since you've done both engineering and architecture, on a scale of 9 to 10, how much better is architecture than engineering?
You know what? They're just different. And it's been so informative for me to teach in a school of architecture. My simple answer to the two faculties when I have them together in a room is to say that engineers teach analysis and they forget to teach design.
Mm-hmm.
And architects teach design and forget to teach analysis.
Fantastic.
And we really need to get a little bit more design into engineering and a little bit more analysis into architecture.
Well, I got to tell you, you know, I remember my school days, and those are the classes that I tried really hard not to fall asleep in. You know, now I wish I paid more attention.
Yeah,
now I realize it's, you know, so what goes on with your students? You know, are they all design focused? And
yes.
I think they're lucky to have you to wake them up, but what's going on there?
Well, yes, they are design focused, but they enough of them have enough experience because we are a co-op school and students go out and go to work every 4 months and they work for like, you know, famous architects in New York and London and Berlin and all that. And then they come back, they are actually more aware. But it's still, that is, frankly, you've nailed it on the head. That is what is the challenge in the culture of architectural schools, is that nobody wants to tell the students that the majority of them will not be doing concept design as a profession, that the majority of them will be doing contract admin. They will be doing site supervision. They will be doing working drawings. They will be meeting with clients, trying to understand what it is they want and explaining why it's maybe not right. Very small portions of a real architecture firm's time is spent on concept design. And about 80, 90% of the education is spent on that small percentage.
Right.
And so as a consequence, we actually create not from an education point, but as much from an attitude and a culture point of view, the graduates and the faculties are actually not at all representative of what the job of architecture is. And as a consequence, it's hard for the students to even learn what they need to when it's presented to them because they've decided that, well, this isn't important.
Mm.
And yes, so that's the challenge.
Yeah, it's very true. And I think I remember at school, the kids who had been out in the real world and then came back, those are the ones who were asking good questions in these classes. And I remember waking up and thinking, oh, there's a lot of different stuff out there that I'm just clueless about.
Yeah.
It's just okay.
So we're on the green building advisor. So there's sort of a difference between building science and green. But
yes.
You know, I know we feel that there's a considerable overlap there. I'm wondering what your take is on that. Like where do you feel building science and green building overlap?
This is like the geeks versus hippies question.
Yes. Geeks versus hippies.
Look, I love it. I completely agree with you that building science is not green building and green building is not building science.
Right.
Building science is a set of tools, skills, and knowledge that lets us deliver buildings that perform in a predictable way. I can use that for good or I can use that for evil.
Hmm.
So I can use it to build a 20,000 square foot mansion with all glass walls facing west and still manage to make the person inside of it comfortable. That isn't green, but that's a classic, actually a very common use of building science, is how do I do stupid things in such a way that people will still be happy with the outcome?
I love it.
That's why Dubai is what like it is, right?
And, well, actually, oftentimes they don't make the people happy, frankly.
Oh, yeah.
They fail, that's real. But green building is actually a bigger sort of a more kind of clear focus, is that it's trying to minimize the impact on the planet. Now, sometimes I think it gets confused with healthy buildings, which is actually not about, you know, good for the planet. Mm-hmm. Frankly, the more people we kill, the better off the planet is. So I would say unhealthy buildings are perhaps green. Mm-hmm. But so that's why this good building is or pretty good building is comes back full circle, is that what we want is we want to have the best possible space for you and I to have this conversation in or to teach a class in or to treat dogs in our vet clinic. But we want to minimize the impact on the planet is resources, mostly so that we can keep doing what we're doing, you know, so that we can have 9 billion people on the planet without the planet stopping to provide services of fresh air, fresh water, food, and resources to us. That's what green building's about. And building science is simply the set of tools. It's the toolbox that lets us try and achieve those goals. They're very different. One's a set of goals and one's a set of tools.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think that's really well stated. What I want to do is talk about your comments on planetary damage as being so important. Passive House, I know you beat up on Passive House a lot, and you know we go back and forth a lot, but there's a metric in Passive House that the primary energy use that really talks about planetary damage. I mean,
well, that's why it was kind of there. That's how the whole standard came about, is reduction in global greenhouse gas emissions and all that, and trying to come up with a house that sits on the planet passively, essentially.
Yeah, well, aren't there some really good tools and metrics that we can use from PHPP in the whole passive house certification?
Yeah, well, so the 120 kilowatt hours a square meter per year, brilliant idea to say, look, it's primary energy, you know, into the power plant energy, great. Mm-hmm. And it's a real number that, you know, you can measure, great. Okay, I don't have any problems with that. I've never said that was a problem. My concern is that, well, then where does the 15 kilowatt hours a square meter of site energy for space heating come from?
Right.
And it's those types of, and why did they choose 120 for primary? Why not 100? I mean, 120, how non-German? Shouldn't it be an order? I mean, pick a number, 10, 100, 1,000. So 120? So this number was chosen, like many of our performance targets, rather arbitrarily, to be something that reached a certain goal with a certain, you know, probability. I mean, like it was a tough goal or an easy goal or whatever, right? Yeah. But that's all it was. There's nothing more particular about that. And it was chosen for buildings, typically residential, multifamily row houses in Central Europe. So the concern I have is, I think that the idea of choosing a number of primary energy is exactly what we should be doing. Frankly, I think that would be a great energy code right there. Done. But I don't see why space heating should be broken out. In fact, it leads to rather odd allocations of resources. Right. And I think the discussion about why 120, well, what should it be? I mean, people pose passive house as being like the ultimate or the most stringent standard. Mm. Well, zero energy is less than 120 last time I checked.
Right.
So is 90.
Right.
So, well, so why do we the 120 number? Well, because it's an arbitrary number and is no more superior to any of the other numbers that are picked. Right. And so, and the problem is it's been proposed as a rock solid chiseled in stone number that we can't play with.
Right. Well, I do know what the, Feist would say, well, only because I asked him sort of that question, like with people who say primary energy should be the only metric. I, you know, the argument is, you know, the space heating number is there because it speaks to the shell, which is a more permanent thing, as opposed to primary energy use is also based on the equipment that comes and goes within the house and the users and all that. So
yeah, but the shell is actually only one of the two components that really affect the space heating use. The other one is climate, and that's conspicuously absent.
Exactly, yes.
So therefore, that's the problem with it, is, you know, and if somebody wanted to say, why 15 then? So what is the metric being used? What is the process being used to come up with 120 or with 1 or 15 so that you can understand it and therefore potentially modify it for Kansas? Mm-hmm. Modify it for International Falls, modify it for Miami. But since it's just a number that came down on high, and we are not allowed, until recently, we were not allowed to ask these questions, it was literally considered horrible that I would even ask the question, well, why 120? Why 15? Couldn't we choose another number?
How dare you, John?
Well, you know, FIAS is kind of, they're considering, I don't want to say retooling, but rethinking their metrics.
No, they've literally sent out emails saying that we're willing to reconsider. Hallelujah, this is great. I think that we'll be, now that we have a lot of more experience in the country about passive house, I think that we should be able to have a good, reasonable discussion that leads to some sort of more acceptable consensus, as opposed to somebody importing a rule that we have to follow. I one of the reasons I felt comfortable criticizing some of the components of Passive House was that I worked in Germany. I was in the construction industry exactly in 1990, 1991, when people were starting the Passive House standard. Mm. I know I continue to travel to Europe, Germany, every 2 to 3 years. I continue to keep good connections with research institutes there. the perception people have of what is what led to Passive House and the supposed scientific rigor and absolute clarity simply isn't supported by the facts. It is a very good energy standard that tries to also include comfort. It doesn't actually deal with other things, but it's good for those things. And there are other programs that are very good at indoor air quality. And there are other programs that are very good at energy in the tract home market and reducing that, like Energy Star. I mean, Energy Star version 3 is not for the weak need.
Mm-hmm.
It will save more energy next year than Passive House times 50.
And yeah. that's because of the scale of houses it affects. Right.
Right. Yeah. And so those are the, you know, so I think we just have to put, there's none of these things are that, Energy Star isn't the be all end all. I mean, if somebody tells me I'm building a low energy house, I want to save the planet, and I just spent $1 million and it's Energy Star, I'd say, what? That's it?
Hmm.
And by the same token, I'm saying, but Passive House doesn't necessarily need to be applied to low income housing in Berkeley.
Right, right.
And so we have to accept that there's these are programs that focus on specific things and not others, and aim at certain markets and not at others, as opposed to saying there is one standard above all, you know, the first commandment, right? I will worship no other standards other than Passive House.
Right. Yeah, yeah, you have to make that pledge to be certified, right? No, I don't know. But well, so
don't you have a tattoo now, Chris?
Yeah, but I can't show it to you. But that, you know, that's like standards. I'd like to get to a more micro level. Like, what do you think's on the horizon, or what's the great technological innovation that we're waiting for? What's the thing that you feel like, you know, we're on the cusp of, sort of tackling?
Well, first of all, I guess there are a bunch of things that are emerging as important technologies to us, but secondly, none of them matter. None of them matter, because what is missing is not the technology. What is missing is the desire. What is missing is the knowledge. What is missing is the process by which we would regularly be building good houses or great houses. Yeah. And we know and have repeatedly demonstrated with 100 other people across this country have built really good homes from a health, durability, aesthetics, energy and resource point of view, and they've done it without having to invent new technology.
Yeah. You know what you just did there? I did the, hey, doctor, what's the new pill that I could take to do this thing? And you said, diet and exercise.
Right.
Get out there. You already know what you need to do. And,
yep.
And I think that's...
Well, he is a doctor.
Are a doctor.
Yes, but that said, I mean, it's nice to have diet pills.
Yeah.
It's great to have machines that, you know, vibrate your flab off your belly. I mean,
you
I bet like one.
Yeah.
But it's not enough, right? I mean, the most important thing is to actually have people show up just to ask the question. And a lot of times people just aren't even showing up, or they don't really even seem to get it. That is what has changed in the last 5 years, is that the people who care about energy and buildings, it's now not just the true believers. It's expanded much more widely.
And you think that's strictly because of, now we're making a better case for it financially. Do you think there's...
I actually think financially is the worst reason in the world.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
And people make all kinds of crazy decisions in buildings that have nothing to do with finances.
Right.
So finances is not going to make the distinction. It helps. It helps. You know, doubling the energy prices really focuses the attention. But it's not going to make the difference. It's because there's been enough of a discussion about energy, environment, national security, et cetera. You know, the problems with fracking, the problems with Libya, the problems with Syria, all the stuff. This is what changes things.
Right. Well, we'll end probably on that. Actually, we'll end with one more question, if you don't mind. We'll just do So, like, you get called into all these crazy places to do things. You know, some are awesome and some are, you know, I can only imagine. But, you know, what's the craziest, like, dumbass thing you've seen? Like, you've walked in and just gone, what were they thinking? Either the architect or the builder. I'm just curious, because that's a fun thing to end
on. Wow. You know, that's tough, you know. It really is tough. I can't think of something off the top, because most of the crazy dumbass things are actually kind of narrow little things.
Mm-hmm.
people who make mistakes in buildings that they thought was a good idea, and it, you know, I mean, in terms of like big picture, oh my gosh, they completely blew it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't really have much I can think of right now, but I am regularly concerned by, you know, when I look at buildings and go, oh my God, how could they possibly have done this?
You yeah. know?
But I mean, they're realistically in the big picture of the whole building, they're usually pretty small.
All right. Well, then I'll change my question to a request that you and Joe do a top 10 dumbass things we've seen or something like that with pictures illustrated. You know, I don't know. Because I think that would be good.
I
honestly. So should we leave it there? I mean, with us saying words like dumbass and all that, Phil? Or
do yeah. You, all right. Well, what else do? What is your current beef? We, you know, what's bothering John these days? For the GBA audience, is there something you just really want to get off your chest? What's bugging you now?
I'm pretty happy in our industry. I think we're making progress is being made. There's lots of short-sighted policies out there. You know, I wish we would be having a long-term plan. I wish we could stop polarizing it from, you know, no fossil fuels or all fossil fuels. You know, those are the kinds of things that are frustrating on a macro level.
Yeah.
But on a day-to-day basis, I have to say we're doing better. You know, every day, the ideas of good buildings has diffused more and more, both commercially and residentially. I think that's we got to keep in mind. That's a good news. I think we need to keep working, and this is not going to happen suddenly over a 2-year period. It's going to take. We're going to keep working at this for the next 20 years, and it's going to be more and more of the same, trying to make it better. That's what we're going to need to do.
Well, Doctor, thank you very much.
John, thank you so much. This has been great fun.
Well, for me too. We'll talk again soon.
Okay,
thank you. Bye.
Cheers.
Yeah.